once more into the breach, dear friends. Let's fill the wall up with our English dip. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. Jake is absent with leave, off at a conference to which he was invited because he's really smart. And that's exactly what they said. And I have to admit that it's true. I'm probably don't qualify as a dummy, but Jake is in many ways smarter than I am, and that's quite impressive. He's my son, and I have to admit that, so that's pretty cool. Well, you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach, and as we said at the first hour, The Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, and it's not coincidental that we call this program and that business the same name, because we're two elements of the same thing. We provide investment advice for people in the form of wealth management, and we manage investment portfolios. And then we come on the air here and give the same general educational information to you that we give to our clients. As a matter of fact, we write a newsletter each week, and the newsletter pretty much gets included in the radio program in what we talk about. It's just that obviously a 700-word or thereabouts newsletter is not as long as, won't fill up 2 hours, so we bring in some more things during this time period, and that's what we do and who we are. And today is December 2nd. It's 11:08, and I'm certainly encouraged by the calls we got in the first hour, and I'd love to have some more. 254-773-1400 is the telephone number. Talked a lot about the tax bill and its pluses and minuses, and I guess one of the key elements is we won't know until the House has passed a tax bill, the Senate's passed a tax bill. They are different, and in some areas they are substantially different. We'll see what comes out. I kind of think it'll be closer to the Senate bill than it will be to the House bill, because once it comes out of the conference committee, it has to go back to the House and Senate for a straight up or down vote, and there was a lot of scrambling in the last few hours yesterday to put provisions in the Senate bill that will enable them to get either 50 or 51 votes so they could get it through the Senate. The key being that the earlier budget resolution was passed by the House and Senate and said it's okay to increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion with the new tax bill, which means it can pass by a simple majority. And if the House were to insist on some of the provisions that the members of the House are quite enthusiastic about, it's pretty clear it wouldn't pass the Senate. So if they're going to get a bill passed of any kind, it's going to have to be pretty much the Senate bill. And the question, of course, is whether the members of the House of Representatives will go along with some of the things that are in the bill that they don't particularly care for. The other thing is, and this is something that in this rush to get a tax bill passed that nobody knows, as far as I know, one of the reasons I don't know what's in it is because I can't find anybody else who does, and it wasn't even published last night or this morning. So until it gets published, we won't know for sure what's in it, but it has been voted on and approved by the Senate. And even after it's published, it'll take a little while. It needs to go through the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation to figure out exactly what it all means, and we won't know any of that for some time. So it looks like we're going to probably get a tax bill, because Republicans need to pass a tax bill. What it means long-term and what provisions are going to be in it is very questionable at this point. We just don't know. But I do think it's going to happen. And it conceivably could add a little bit to corporate earnings next year. It could add something to the GDP next year. The consensus forecast among economists is, without the tax bill, is about a 2.5% growth in GDP next year. Now, whether that's accurate or not is questionable, but it's higher than it has been. And They are saying right now about 2.8% growth in GDP next year on average, or for the year, if the tax bill passes. And the difficulty, of course, is one of the things we don't know is what that will do to inflation. And if it does start, if the additional money coming into the United States in a labor shortage condition, which we're in right now, generates higher inflation, then the Federal Reserve will start raising interest rates, which will take that money right back out of the system again. So we could wind up with higher interest rates, some inflation, and no net increase in tax revenue. That's the thing that has the economists worried. Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. And so, caller, you're on the air with the Person Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes. You said ABC News reported that Trump, or rather Flynn, was told by Trump to contact this. Mm-hmm. ABC recanted that. They made a
Okay. Well, and, then I certainly join in their recanting. That's why I say ABC News reported rather than he said it, because I don't know what, who said to whom, and I discount leaks. The key, and what I and thank you for bringing that to my attention, the key is that the reporting of this event, as it turns out, was incorrect, but the reporting of the event had only a temporary minor effect on the market, whereas historically, the reporting of such an event by a mainstream media organization would have caused a panic in the market.
Right. Well, I hate to jump on the fake news bandwagon, but there's been such an effort from some of the media and certainly the Democrats to discredit Trump that I think that the market reacted like this. If something's going to happen to Trump, you know, Flynn made a deal. And then when they figured out what the deal was, the market shot back up. You know,
I don't know that they figured out what the deal was. I think it was a matter of, in fact, what actually happened, the drop was so quick. I mean, it was within seconds, a 400-point drop in the Dow. No trader can move that fast. That was an algorithm. That was a computer-generated algorithm, or a series of them that were reacting to each other, that had been programmed that if this happens, do that. And once the people, once everybody looked around and said, what has that got to do with the price of eggs in China? And then they started buying, they saw it as a buying opportunity and moved back in. That's the news to me. It is everything that's going on with this investigation, as with the tax bill. We know a lot more about the tax bill than we know about the investigation. All we know is rumor and innuendo. And it may be much ado about nothing. And you mentioned fake news. I don't know that there's that much fake news out there. What I do know is that because of things like the Drudge Report and online reporting, where you get sensational daily, moment by moment, you get sensational reporting that sometimes turns out to be true and sometimes doesn't. You have a tremendous competition to be the first one to report something.
Yeah.
Well, and that means that there's not time to investigate it. They just, I heard this and here it is. And I don't know, I honestly don't know that there's that much fake news going on. I think it's mostly just fast news. Every human being has a bias. And I do all my news gathering online. And I go through everything from Fox to CNN. And find out that generally speaking, and if you really want this is a plug for the Wall Street Journal online, you got to pay for it. Like Financial Times and Wall Street Journal are each a couple of $100 a year to subscribe to. And a lot of times they are not the first ones out with a story. They report, for instance, their report that I read said ABC reported it. That's true. And
yeah, they did.
And the issue is that until the Wall Street Journal confirms it, I simply say ABC reported that, and it had this effect on the market.
Right.
Or didn't.
As a businessman, and I've had and sold several businesses and have a couple now, I look at Trump staying in office as being good for business. I mean, we struggled through the anti-business, anti-capitalist 8 years of Obama. The economy was good enough and to overcome what he did. I mean,
you and I are in the same boat on that one, buddy. My son and I own a business, and we have, admittedly, maybe small compared with yours. We have 10 employees and a lot of things going on at any given moment. And it seemed like the Secretary of Labor, who is now the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, was determined to put small businesses out of business.
I certainly felt assaulted.
And Elizabeth Warren believes that, sometimes I think she believes that being in business and making a profit is inherently evil. So, you and I agree. Whether or not Trump is good for... Trump is the least worst, from my perspective. I do think that Jamie Dimon, I don't know if you heard his comments at the Business Roundtable.
No, I did not.
He was asked, Business Roundtable is a combination of the CEOs of the largest American corporations, and they do make recommendations, and they do try to influence both Congress and the president. And he was asked how long he thinks Trump's tenure will be, and he said, as things are running right now, about 3.5 years. And what that means is he expects him to be impeached. He said, on the other hand, if the Democrats don't come up with a business-friendly attitude and a business-friendly candidate, he could get reelected.
Yeah, well, the Democrats are going to go with the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders type socialist.
We'll see. You know, that's another speculative thing where we don't know what they're going to do. I mean, I would love to see another Bill Clinton-like president. Whether or not you liked Bill Clinton, he was distinctly pro-business and pro-trade and was definitely good for the economy. All you have to do is look at the fact that we managed to go to a surplus while he was in office, and the stock market boomed. Admittedly, it boomed too much, but...
That was during the irrational exuberance.
Yeah, exactly. Irrational exuberance. But basically, he had, you know, remember when he was first running for office, what the big banner he had up in his head in his campaign headquarters? It's the economy, stupid.
Right.
And I would love to have a president who, strictly from a business perspective, from whatever party, who had that banner up in their headquarters again. It's the economy, stupid. Because... You know, I mentioned this earlier in the last hour, and I've done a lot of research on it, and I've written on it. Political events do not have long-term effects in the market. Economic events do. Political events do not have long-term effects in the economy. Economic effects do. And that's why I don't get too excited about it. I will say this. I think if we wind up in an impeachment battle, which, by the way, is a distinct possibility after 2018, that will be damaging to the morale and the conditions of the economy. So I hope we don't have one.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, before I hang up, I certainly do enjoy your show here and learn a lot on it and try to listen to it. Even though I got to work all the time, as much as I can.
Well, you know, work is a four-letter word.
Pardon?
Work is a four-letter word.
That's true. Hey, well, thank you very much. You have a good week.
Well, thank you for listening, and thank you for the call. And this remains the Personal Wealth Coach, and I remain Jeff McClure. And you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. I was trying to give you your office number, and you're not going to get an answer there. So what else is going on in the world? The Eurozone is recovering. And I have to say, yay! And why do I say yay? Because a big chunk of American corporation profits are now coming out of Europe, and they're also coming out of the other big player, which I started to talk about earlier, which is China. So there's three big players and a secondary player, and the three big players are China, the United States, and Europe. The other player isn't a single entity. It's what we call emerging markets other than China. And collectively, they are doing exceptionally well this year. Europe is coming out of recession. The quantitative easing is still going on there. The amazing thing, and I'm going to get to a caller we've got right now, but the amazing thing, I just want to mention this, is for the first time in over a decade, and in many cases 14 years, businesses are starting to raise prices a little bit in Japan. Japan has been in deflation for a decade and a half. And the fact that they're beginning to raise prices a little bit is hugely wonderful. I don't know if it's going to work out, but we'll see. And caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi.
You are the person.
I wanted to make one quick point. The initial announcement was misquoted on the news, and then the other guys followed that. They said that Mr. Flynn implicated President Trump as the one telling him, you know, to talk to the Russians, and then they had to retract that. And I noticed that CNN retracted on their Fact Money page, but what President Trump told him was, you know, contact them or come up with ideas how we can work with them.
Mm-hmm. We don't know. Actually, we don't know what was said yet, and we won't until Michael Flynn testifies.
They retracted their initial statement, though, which probably had something to do with the initial drop and then the rebound, I thought.
Well, actually, no, the statement, the rebound was well underway before the statement came out. What caused the drop? It was within seconds of the announcement that Michael Flynn had chosen to plead guilty to a minor charge, which meant he was, by definition, working with the prosecutors before anything else came out. That hit, and literally within 15 seconds, the market started falling, and within a minute, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 400 points. That's why I say there wasn't time for people to hear that and think about it and consider what the implications were. That was something that somebody had programmed into a computer, and they had may have had somebody sitting there who says, if Michael Flynn pleads guilty to a minor charge, press this button.
Yes, sir. One other thing I wanted to ask about. That's why I talked to you, because I didn't know these things. The inflation, aren't we due for an inflation or for the tax or for the interest rate to be bumped back up?
Interest rates are coming back up, but what we're not getting is anything like the inflation in the U.S. economy, in our system, that previous economic hypotheses would have called for. In other words, we had a pretty clear relationship between unemployment and inflation that went on for a long time, and was a lot of papers written about it, and there was a pretty clear relationship between unemployment and GDP growth and the need for the Fed to raise interest rates because we would get inflation automatically, and it was pretty reliable through the 20th century. Right now,
in the 70s.
Yeah, and it basically, we're running scared of inflation with good cause, because we had some big inflation back in the last half of the 20th century. But what was not programmed into this, and there's a lot of deep thought going into this right now, is the fact that in the past, the United States was sort of an island economy. And what went on in the rest of the world had little effect on the United States. Now, what happened in the United States had a profound effect on the rest of the world, but not the other way around. But that's not true anymore. We are no longer, by most definitions, the largest economy in the world. China is.
Right.
But if you
step back a step and realize that Canada, the United States, and Mexico are in essence one economy right now. Then we're bigger than China. And then you step a further step back and say, what percentage of our economy is the corporations that make up the S&P 500 stock index, for example? And you say, oh, a big piece. And then we say, okay, their profits, their profitability drives so much in the U.S. economy. And about 40% of their profits right now are coming from outside the United States. Man, it starts to get really, really complicated. By the way, this has happened before in history. Back in the 19th century, before the Civil War, the United States was distinct regions. And they even had their own money, by the way. Each region had its own banknotes that it used. So New England was a distinct area that did that had its own economy, and it rose and fell on its own. And the 13 states of the South that became the Confederacy had their own economy. And what was called the West or Midwest, I don't know if you ever wondered why Ohio is considered the Midwest when it's way east. That's because the western border of the United States at that point was the Mississippi River.
And did they increase tariffs at that time too?
Well, there was a lot of things that went on during that period of time, that including some nasty tariff increases to try to protect American jobs. I don't know if that sounds familiar.
Yes.
But so what happened is we transitioned with the advent of the steam railroad running all over the country following following the Civil War. So that we were no longer separate economies. As a matter of fact, part of what led to the Civil War was the breakdown in these separate economies, and the South, economically, the South got left behind. Not banking. Right. Banking did become widespread, but still regional banks dominated. It was the fact that the primary labor source in the South was slaves. And slaves, by definition, could not be illiterate. That was against the law. They couldn't be educated. They couldn't operate skilled equipment. The North, on the other hand, through the use of the steam engine, was industrializing at a high rate of speed. And the skill quality of the workers in the North, their education, their ability to operate more complex equipment that increased their productivity rose very quickly.
Yes, sir.
And it hurt, but it hurt more in England than it did in New England, because the cottage industries of, you know, making shirts in your house and sewing in the house and the spinning wheel and all of that were displaced by factories. And it was, you know, there was some real unhappiness and some real problems in New England. But the entire block of southern states, the 13 southern states, got left behind. And they were in a world of hurt economically, and they got very, very angry at the situation and decided to cut off relationships with everybody else by forming their own country. Now, that country was not economically viable. It wasn't even economically viable enough to fund a war that they could win. But
right.
If we bounce forward to today, in our memory, in the memory of most adults, the United States was an island economy. It was its own internal economy. We didn't need the rest of the world. We didn't think, anyway. And, you know, except maybe to import oil. And now we're becoming oil independent, so who cares? That ain't true anymore. We don't have the labor force. We don't have a lot of things that we need to keep our standard of living where it is at the price we pay for it. For example, if you go to the store today, the grocery store, you expect to see fresh fruits and vegetables and flowers, right?
Yes, sir.
Do you think those came from the United States?
No, I know they didn't.
They came from South America in most cases, or maybe from Africa. And as a result, there is so much, and that's just a very, very tiny example of the fact that we are rapidly moving into a world that is economically integrated. And that's a good thing, but the for because it causes everybody's it's Adam Smith winning the war with Karl Marx. Everybody's welfare is lifted as though by an invisible hand because there's more trade and there's more exchange of goods and services and money. But here's the problem. With that comes, that is a result of an increase in technological advances. And if you're not one of the people who either through your, where you live, or through your education, or your health, or your age, or whatever, can participate in that, you're going to be left behind, and you're going to be very unhappy about it. And whole communities are going to be left behind, and are. And the people in those communities, and the people who got left behind because they don't have the education or the location to participate in a rapidly expanding, highly technological economy, those people are going to be very, very, very unhappy. And when whole regions get left behind, we wind up with wars.
Oh. Well, I thought that we were due for inflation based on they've kept the interest rates so low so
no.
long to build up the economy.
They actually didn't keep interest rates low. They were trying. The Federal Reserve would love to see interest rates higher. They would love to see inflation higher. Inflation generates rising interest rates, by the way.
Right.
And we're just not getting the inflation. Well, the reason we're not getting inflation is the same reason they didn't get the inflation in the 1830s that they expected.
Okay.
Because we're having, you have the cheap labor can now be used. For example, with the advent of the steam engine, in New England, I'll just give you an example. In New England, they had a lot of waterfalls. They don't have them in the South. The waterfalls generated energy to run the factories. Once the Civil War was over, and the barriers broke down, you had a lot of unemployed people in the South, and you could put in steam engines instead of waterfalls. And so clothing and shoe manufacturing was the staple of New England. It moved to the South because labor was cheaper. And New England went into a depression. They were used to a high standard of living, and they were used to doing a lot of things. And they really were in a hurt when large chunks of manufacturing that had originally up in New England, what they had done is they spent their long winters in their houses, it was called cottage industry, making clothes and shoes. Well, then along comes the waterfall-powered factory, and so the people had to leave their houses and go to factory jobs and child labor and all kinds of bad things. But clothes got cheaper, so more people could afford more clothes. Then I'm compressing an awful lot into a short period of time. Then along comes the steam engine, and those factories started shutting down. And it went on, actually, into the 20th century, this was still going. Berkshire Hathaway was a clothing manufacturing company that was bought by Warren Buffett. His investors gave him money, and he bought the company because it was a pure value company. It was so cheap, and then he realized why it was so cheap. It was so cheap because they weren't going to be able to stay in business making clothes in New England because the cost of living was too high.
Oh, okay.
So he got completely out of the clothes-making business, made it into an investment company. But Berkshire Hathaway was a clothes-making business, and there's still some clothes-making business. L.L. Bean and Woolrich and a bunch of companies are still up there, traditional clothes-making companies. Now, very interestingly, they do not manufacture the clothes in New England. The clothes are manufactured in Asia. They're designed in New England, manufactured in Asia, and shipped to the United States. And that's the same thing. Basically, the jumbo jet became the railroad of the 20th century. And it's still going on. And it's going to continue to go on. And you either get on board and run with it, or you get left behind. And that's one of the great stresses that occurs in any economy. Are we going to... And that's the question we're asking when it comes to the current political situation. The question that we really need to answer is, are we going to join the rest of the world in specialization where we do the designing, the quality control, the marketing, the thinking, the back office stuff where you sit in an air-conditioned office in front of a computer, or do we want to try to compete in manufacturing with the unwashed hordes of Mexico and China? No. If we tried to continue to compete for manufacturing jobs with low-wage countries, low-cost-of-living countries, we're toast. Because we can't. And you either participate in the world economy or you don't. It's like saying, if I'm going to have a business, but I'm only going to sell to residents of Salado. That means when people come in from outside of Salado because they drove their cars in, or people come online from Dallas and they want to buy something from me, and I say no.
Well, you say I'm going to charge you more.
Yeah, well, if I say I'm going to charge you more, then they're not going to buy it from me.
Right.
And so that means that it was the clock is ticking until my business in Salado goes out of business. But the reality is we do business all the way around the world, and that's one of the neat things about being in Salado in the age of the Internet is we can have clients in Europe, and we can have clients in Japan. We can have clients all over the place. And we can do business with them, give them investment advice. Now, admittedly, they're all Americans, and they speak English, but still, they are all over the place. Whereas in the past, oddly enough, in the distant past, that would have been illegal. So we either, our business has survived and thrived because we've been willing to not limit the locale in which we do business, and we use. But the other thing is, and I mentioned this, you know, outsourcing of jobs to Mexico and India and China and so on. But here's a key element that a lot of people don't understand, and I can illustrate it with the VCR. Do you remember VCRs?
Yes, sir.
Well, the VCR were invented in the United States. They were initially all manufactured in the United States. And then gradually it got to the point, it was in the 1990s, where somebody woke up and said, there isn't a single VCR made in the United States anymore. And they're widely used and people are using. This is what they use. And we said on the radio at the time, and it's certainly true, that means the VCR is about to go away. And so what happens is when a job leaves its point of origin and goes to a lower labor position, that means the job is about to vanish. It's just a matter of when. And so the two big, it isn't just outsourcing. I don't know if you used to go to car washes where people washed your car if you're old enough, but I used to go to car washes where you pay and human beings would wash your car. And there were a lot more human beings employed washing cars at that point. Then machines started washing cars. And finally, in many cases, and I strongly suspect the majority of car washes in the United States, there is no human being there. And that's the way everything is going. And so what happened to the people who used to work at car washes? Well, maybe they're doing checkout at the grocery store right now. Now, obviously, they grew up and they got older and they don't do that anymore. But their generational slot is maybe filled by somebody at Brookshire Brothers in Salado who is doing checkouts and somebody's filling up bags. And if you go to Austin where things are a little ahead of us, you will notice that the majority of people checking out, there's no human being there. And that is a little inconvenient right now, but it's about to get really convenient where you basically, I don't know if it's already going on in New England and California, where you pull your shopping cart up and a scanner reads everything in the cart and presents you with a bill. And you tap your smartphone against the machine and it's paid, and you push your cart out to your car and unload the stuff. No human being involved. And that's the way the economy is going. And the people who get left behind are the people who are going to be very, very unhappy. And the one thing that human beings have that they can do that machines can't do and won't ever do is critical thinking. Machines are getting better and better at it, but if human beings become educated in how to think, and how to solve problems, and how to get ahead of the power curve rather than doing something by rote memory, they're going to be in good shape. But I've read several very, very, very well-reasoned papers with a lot of evidential data in them that suggest that anywhere from 25 to 40% of the jobs that exist in the United States today will not exist in 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with that. And that's why we're not having, and you ask why we're not having inflation. We're not having inflation because of globalization. There, inflation is where you have more demand than you have supply and the price goes up.
Right.
But if you have the whole world ready to supply us, and if you raise your prices for what you're doing, somebody else won't, and you lose money on the deal because nobody will buy your stuff. So you can't have inflation. And, of course, then when there's a higher demand for labor, this is going on at the same time. This is why wages have not gone up a lot. When there's a high demand for labor, business has a choice between raising what they're paying their employees, which is probably their single largest expense right now, and becoming non-competitive and going out of business, or buying a robot.
Right.
And by the way, this tax bill encourages that by allowing unlimited Section 179 deductions, meaning if a company historically